An Outline of Intellectual Rubbish, Bertrand Russell. The godson of John Stuart Mill had several careers as philosopher, mathematician, and opponent of injustice. His rather disordered private life also helped furnish the material for a notable autobiography. At different times, his stubborn views on sexual freedom and the dangers of war and empire caused him to be banned from teaching in the United States and imprisoned in the United Kingdom. A single pamphlet, Why I Am Not a Christian, became a classic from which the Christian churches have yet to recover. I chose this essay, written in the very dark year of 1943, because it expresses a certain stoical optimism, and because it connects the nonsense of religious belief to the prevalence of other popular superstitions. In his extraordinarily prescient Practice and Theory of Bolshevism, written just after the Russian Revolution, Russell distinguished himself by being one of the first to notice the connection between modern totalitarian thought and the religious impulse toward subjection. Man is a rational animal, so at least I have been told. Throughout a long life I have looked diligently for evidence in favor of this statement, but so far I have not had the good fortune to come across it, though I have searched in many countries spread over three continents. On the contrary, I have seen the world plunging continually further into madness. I have seen great nations, formerly leaders of civilization, led astray by preachers of bombastic nonsense. I have seen cruelty, persecution, and superstition increasing by leaps and bounds, until we have almost reached the point where praise of rationality is held to mark a man as an old fogey, regrettably surviving from a bygone age. All this is depressing, but gloom is a useless emotion. In order to escape from it, I have been driven to study the past with more attention than I had formerly given to it, and have found, as Erasmus found, that folly is perennial, and yet the human race has survived. The follies of our own times are easier to bear when they are seen against the background of past follies. In what follows, I shall mix the silliness of our day with those of former centuries. Perhaps the result may help in seeing our own times in perspective, and as not much worse than other ages that our ancestors lived through without ultimate disaster. Aristotle, so far as I know, was the first man to proclaim explicitly that man is a rational animal. His reason for this view was one which does not now seem very impressive. It was that some people can do sums. He thought that there are three kinds of soul: the vegetable soul, possessed by all living things, both plants and animals, and concerned only with nourishment and growth; the animal soul, concerned with locomotion and shared by man with the lower animals; and finally, the rational soul, or intellect, which is the divine mind, but in which men participate to a greater or lesser degree in proportion to their wisdom. It is in virtue of the intellect that man is a rational animal. The intellect is shown in various ways, but most emphatically by mastery of arithmetic. The Greek system of numerals was very bad, so that the multiplication table was quite difficult, and complicated calculations could only be made by very clever people. Nowadays, however, calculating machines do sums better than even the cleverest people, yet no one contends that these useful instruments are immortal, or work by divine inspiration. As arithmetic has grown easier, it has come to be less respected. The consequence is that, though many philosophers continue to tell us what fine fellows we are, it is no longer on account of our arithmetical skill that they praise us. Since the fashion of the age no longer allows us to point to calculating boys as evidence that man is rational and the soul, at least in part, immortal, let us look elsewhere. Where shall we look first? Shall we look among eminent statesmen, who have so triumphantly guided the world to its present condition? Or shall we choose the men of letters, or the philosophers? All these have their claims, but I think we should begin with those whom all right-thinking people acknowledge to be the wisest, as well as the best of men, namely, the clergy. If they fail to be rational, what hope is there for us lesser mortals? And alas, though I say it with all due respect, there have been times when their wisdom has not been very obvious, and strange to say, these were especially the times when the power of the clergy was greatest. The ages of faith which are praised by our neo-scholastics, were the time when the clergy had things all their own way. Daily life was full of miracles, wrought by saints, and wizardry perpetrated by devils and necromancers. Many thousands of witches were burnt at the stake. Men's sins were punished by pestilence and famine, by earthquake, flood, and fire. And yet, strange to say, they were even more sinful than they are nowadays. Very little was known scientifically about the world. A few learned men remembered Greek proofs that the earth is round, but most people made fun of the notion that there are antipodes. To suppose that there are human beings at the antipodes was heresy. It was generally held, though modern Catholics take a milder view, that the immense majority of mankind are damned. Dangers were held to lurk at every turn. Devils would settle on the food that monks were about to eat, and would take possession of the bodies of incautious feeders, who omitted to make the sign of the cross before each mouthful. Old-fashioned people still say, "Bless you," when one sneezes, but they have forgotten the reason for the custom. The reason was that people were thought to sneeze out their souls, and before their souls could get back, lurking demons were apt to enter the unsouled body. But if anyone said, "God bless you," the demons were frightened off. Throughout the last 400 years, during which the growth of science had gradually shown men how to acquire knowledge of the ways of nature and mastery over natural forces, the clergy have fought a losing battle against science. In astronomy and geology, in anatomy and physiology, in biology and psychology and sociology. Ousted from one position, they have taken up another. After being worsted in astronomy, they did their best to prevent the rise of geology. They fought against Darwin in biology, and at the present time, they fight against scientific theories of psychology and education. At each stage, they try to make the public forget their earlier obscurantism, in order that their present obscurantism may not be recognized for what it is. Let us note a few instances of irrationality amongst the clergy since the rise of science, and then inquire whether the rest of mankind are any better. When Benjamin Franklin invented the lightning rod, the clergy, both in England and America, with the enthusiastic support of George III, condemned it as an impious attempt to defeat the will of God. For, as all right-thinking people were aware, lightning is sent by God to punish impiety or some other grave sin. The virtuous are never struck by lightning. Therefore, if God wants to strike anyone, Benjamin Franklin ought not to defeat his design. Indeed, to do so is helping criminals to escape. But God was equal to the occasion. If we are to believe the eminent Dr. Price, one of the leading divines of Boston, lightning, having been rendered ineffectual by the iron points invented by the sagacious Dr. Franklin, Massachusetts was shaken by earthquakes, which Dr. Price perceived to be due to God's wrath at the iron points. In a sermon on the subject, he said, "In Boston are more erected than anywhere else in New England, and Boston seems to be more dreadfully shaken. Oh, there is no getting out of the mighty hand of God." Apparently, however, Providence gave up all hope of curing Boston of its wickedness, for though lightning rods became more and more common, earthquakes in Massachusetts have remained rare. Nevertheless, Dr. Price's point of view, or something very like it, is still held by one of the most influential of living men. When, at one time, there were several bad earthquakes in India, Mahatma Gandhi solemnly warned his compatriots that these disasters had been sent as a punishment for their sins. Even in my own native island, this point of view still exists. During the last war, the British government did much to stimulate the production of food at home. In 1916, when things were not going well, a Scottish clergyman wrote to the newspapers to say that military failure was due to the fact that, with government sanction, potatoes had been planted on the Sabbath. However, disaster was averted, owing to the fact that the Germans disobeyed all the Ten Commandments, and not only one of them. Sometimes, if pious men are to be believed, God's mercies are curiously selective. Toplady, the author of Rock of Ages, moved from one vicarage to another. A week after the move, the vicarage he had formerly occupied burnt down, with great loss to the new vicar. Thereupon, Toplady thanked God. But what the new vicar did is not known. Borrow, in his Bible in Spain, records how without mishap he crossed a mountain pass infested by bandits. The next party to cross, however, were set upon, robbed, and some of them murdered. When Borrow heard of this, he, like Toplady, thanked God. Although we are taught the Copernican astronomy in our textbooks, it has not yet penetrated to our religion or our morals, and has not even succeeded in destroying belief in astrology. People still think that the divine plan has special reference to human beings, and that a special providence not only looks after the good, but also punishes the wicked. I am sometimes shocked by the blasphemies of those who think themselves pious, for instance, the nuns who never take a bath without wearing a bathrobe all the time. When asked why, since no man can see them, they reply, "Oh, but you forget the good God." Apparently they conceive of the deity as a peeping Tom, whose omnipotence enables him to see through bathroom walls, but who is foiled by bathrobes. This view strikes me as curious. The whole conception of sin is one which I find very puzzling, doubtless owing to my sinful nature. If sin consisted in causing needless suffering, I could understand. But on the contrary, sin often consists in avoiding needless suffering. Some years ago, in the English House of Lords, a bill was introduced to legalize euthanasia in cases of painful and incurable disease. The patient's consent was to be necessary, as well as several medical certificates. To me, in my simplicity, it would seem natural to require the patient's consent, but the late Archbishop of Canterbury, the English official expert on sin, explained the erroneousness of such a view. The patient's consent turns euthanasia into suicide, and suicide is sin. Their lordships listened to the voice of authority and rejected the bill. Consequently, to please the Archbishop and his God, if he reports truly, victims of cancer still have to endure months of wholly useless agony, unless their doctors or nurses are sufficiently humane to risk a charge of murder. I find difficulty in the conception of a God who gets pleasure from contemplating such tortures. And if there were a God capable of such wanton cruelty, I should certainly not think him worthy of worship. But that only proves how sunk I am in moral depravity. I am equally puzzled by the things that are sin and by the things that are not. When the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals asked the Pope for his support, he refused it, on the ground that human beings owe no duty to the lower animals, and that ill-treating animals is not sinful. This is because animals have no souls. On the other hand, it is wicked to marry your deceased wife's sister, so at least the Church teaches, however much you and she may wish to marry. This is not because of any unhappiness that might result, but because of certain texts in the Bible. The resurrection of the body, which is an article of the Apostles' Creed, is a dogma which has various curious consequences. There was an author not very many years ago who had an ingenious method of calculating the date of the end of the world. He argued that there must be enough of the necessary ingredients of a human body to provide everybody with the requisites at the last day. By carefully calculating the available raw material, he decided that it would all have been used up by a certain date. When that date comes, the world must end, since otherwise the resurrection of the body would become impossible. Unfortunately, I have forgotten what the date was, but I believe it is not very distant. St. Thomas Aquinas, the official philosopher of the Catholic Church, discussed lengthily and seriously a very grave problem, which, I fear, modern theologians unduly neglect. He imagines a cannibal who has never eaten anything but human flesh, and whose father and mother before him had like propensities. Every particle of his body belongs rightfully to someone else. We cannot suppose that those who have been eaten by cannibals are to go short through all eternity. But if not, what is left for the cannibal? How is he to be properly roasted in hell if all his body is restored to its original owners? This is a puzzling question, as the saint rightly perceives. In this connection, the Orthodox have a curious objection to cremation, which seems to show an insufficient realization of God's omnipotence. It is thought that a body which has been burnt will be more difficult for him to collect together again than one which has been put underground and transformed into worms. no doubt collecting the particles from the air and undoing the chemical work of combustion would be somewhat laborious, but it is surely blasphemous to suppose such a work impossible for the deity. I conclude that the objection to cremation implies grave heresy, but I doubt whether my opinion will carry much weight with the Orthodox. It was only very slowly and reluctantly that the Church sanctioned the dissection of corpses in connection with the study of medicine. The pioneer in dissection was Vesalius, who was court physician to the Emperor Charles V. His medical skill led the emperor to protect him, but after the emperor was dead, he got into trouble. A corpse which he was dissecting was said to have shown signs of life under the knife, and he was accused of murder. The Inquisition was introduced by King Philip II to take a lenient view, and only sentenced him to a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. On the way home, he was shipwrecked and died of exhaustion. For centuries after this time, medical students at the Papal University in Rome were only allowed to operate on lay figures, from which the sexual parts were omitted. The sacredness of corpses is a widespread belief. It was carried furthest by the Egyptians, among whom it led to the practice of mummification. It still exists in full force in China. A French surgeon who was employed by the Chinese to teach Western medicine relates that his demand for corpses to dissect was received with horror, but he was assured that he could have, instead, an unlimited supply of live criminals. His objection to this alternative was totally unintelligible to his Chinese employers. Although there are many kinds of sin, seven of which are deadly, the most fruitful field for Satan's wiles is sex. The Orthodox Catholic doctrine on this subject is to be found in St. Paul, St. Augustine, and St. Thomas Aquinas. It is best to be celibate, but those who have not the gift of continence may marry. Intercourse in marriage is not sin, provided it is motivated by desire for offspring. All intercourse outside marriage is sin, and so is intercourse within marriage, if any measures are adopted to prevent conception. Interruption of pregnancy is sin, even if, in medical opinion, it is the only way of saving the mother's life. For medical opinion is fallible, and God can always save a life by a miracle if he sees fit. This view is embodied in the law of Connecticut. Venereal disease is God's punishment for sin. It is true that, through a guilty husband, this punishment may fall on an innocent woman and her children, but this is a mysterious dispensation of providence, which it would be impious to question. We must also not inquire why venereal disease was not divinely instituted until the time of Columbus. Since it is the appointed penalty for sin, all measures for its avoidance are also sin, except, of course, a virtuous life. Marriage is nominally indissolvable, but many people who seem to be married are not. In the case of influential Catholics, some ground for nullity can often be found, but for the poor there is no such outlet, except perhaps in cases of impotence. Persons who divorce and remarry are guilty of adultery in the sight of God. The phrase, in the sight of God, puzzles me. One would suppose that God sees everything, but apparently this is a mistake. He does not see reno, for you cannot be divorced in the sight of God. Registry offices are a doubtful point. I notice that respectable people, who would not call on anybody who lives in open sin, are quite willing to call on people who have had only a civil marriage. So apparently God does see registry offices. Some eminent men think even the doctrine of the Catholic Church deplorably lacks where sex is concerned. Tolstoy and Mahatma Gandhi, in their old age, laid it down that all sexual intercourse is wicked, even in marriage, and with a view to offspring. The Manichaeans thought likewise, relying upon men's native sinfulness to supply them with a continually fresh crop of disciples. This doctrine, however, is heretical, though it is equally heretical to maintain that marriage is as praiseworthy as celibacy. Tolstoy thinks tobacco almost as bad as sex. In one of his novels, a man who is contemplating murder smokes a cigarette first, in order to generate the necessary homicidal fury. Tobacco, however, is not prohibited in the scriptures, though, as Samuel Butler points out, St. Paul would no doubt have denounced it, if he had known of it. It is odd that neither the Church nor modern public opinion condemns petting, provided it stops short at a certain point. At what point sin begins is a matter as to which casuists differ. One eminently orthodox Catholic divine laid it down that a confessor may fondle a nun's breasts, provided he does it without evil intent. But I doubt whether modern authorities would agree with him on this point. Modern morals are a mixture of two elements. On the one hand, rational precepts as to how to live together peaceably in a society, and on the other hand, traditional taboos derived originally from some ancient superstition, but proximately from sacred books. Christian, Mohammedan, Hindu, or Buddhist. To some extent the two agree. The prohibition of murder and theft, for instance, is supported both by human reason and by divine command. But the prohibition of pork or beef has only scriptural authority, and that only in certain religions. It is odd that modern men, who are aware of what science has done in the way of bringing new knowledge and altering the conditions of social life, should still be willing to accept the authority of text, embodying the outlook of very ancient and very ignorant pastoral or agricultural tribes. It is discouraging that many of the precepts, whose sacred character is thus uncritically acknowledged, should be such as to inflict much wholly unnecessary misery. If men's kindly impulses were stronger, they would find some way of explaining that these precepts are not to be taken literally, any more than the command to sell all that thou hast and give to the poor. There are logical difficulties in the notion of sin. We are told that sin consists in disobedience to God's commands. But we are also told that God is omnipotent. If he is, nothing contrary to his will can occur. Therefore, when the sinner disobeys his commands, he must have intended this to happen. Saint Augustine boldly accepts this view and asserts that men are led to sin by a blindness with which God afflicts them. But most theologians in modern times have felt that if God causes men to sin, it is not fair to send them to hell for what they cannot help. We are told that sin consists in acting contrary to God's will. This, however, does not get rid of the difficulty. Those who, like Spinoza, take God's omnipotence seriously, deduce that there can be no such thing as sin. This leads to frightful results. What? Said Spinoza's contemporaries. Was it not wicked of Nero to murder his mother? Was it not wicked of Adam to eat the apple? Is one action just as good as another? Spinoza wriggles, but does not find any satisfactory answer. If everything happens in accordance with God's will, God must have wanted Nero to murder his mother. Therefore, since God is good, the murder must have been a good thing. From this argument, there is no escape. On the other hand, those who are in earnest in thinking that sin is disobedience to God are compelled to say that God is not omnipotent. This gets out of all the logical puzzles and is the view adopted by a certain school of liberal theologians. It has, however, its own difficulties. How are we to know what really is God's will? If the forces of evil have a certain share of power, they may deceive us into accepting as scripture what is really their work. This was the view of the Gnostics, who thought that the Old Testament was the work of an evil spirit. As soon as we abandon our own reason and are content to rely upon authority, there is no end to our troubles. Whose authority? The Old Testament? The New Testament? The Quran? In practice, people choose the book considered sacred by the community in which they are born, and out of that book, they choose the parts they like, ignoring the others. At one time, the most influential text in the Bible was, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live." Nowadays, people pass over this text, in silence if possible, if not with an apology. And so, even when we have a sacred book, we still choose as truth whatever suits our own prejudices. No Catholic, for instance, takes seriously the text which says that a bishop should be the husband of one wife. People's beliefs have various causes. One is that there is some evidence for the belief in question. We apply this to matters of fact, such as, what is so-and-so's telephone number? Or, who won the World Series? But as soon as it comes to anything more debatable, the causes of belief become less defensible. We believe, first and foremost, what makes us feel that we are fine fellows. Mr. Homo, if he has a good digestion and a sound income, thinks to himself how much more sensible He is than his neighbour so-and-so, who married a flighty wife and is always losing money. He thinks how superior his city is to the one 50 miles away. It has a bigger chamber of commerce and a more enterprising rotary club, and its mayor has never been in prison. He thinks how immeasurably his country surpasses all others. If he is an Englishman, he thinks of Shakespeare and Milton, or of Newton and Darwin, or of Nelson and Wellington, according to his temperament. If he is a Frenchman, he congratulates himself on the fact that for centuries France has led the world in culture, fashions, and cookery. If he is a Russian, he reflects that he belongs to the only nation which is truly international. If he is a Yugoslav, he boasts of his nation's pigs. If a native of the Principality of Monaco, he boasts of leading the world in the matter of gambling. But these are not the only matters on which he has to congratulate himself. For is he not an individual of the species Homo sapiens? Alone among animals, he has an immortal soul and is rational. He knows the difference between good and evil, and has learnt the multiplication table. Did not God make him in his own image? And was not everything created for man's convenience? The sun was made to light the day, and the moon to light the night, though the moon, by some oversight, only shines during half the nocturnal hours. The raw fruits of the earth were made for human sustenance. Even the white tails of rabbits, according to some theologians, have a purpose, namely to make it easier for sportsmen to shoot them. There are, it is true, some inconveniences. Lions and tigers are too fierce, the summer is too hot, and the winter too cold. But these things only began after Adam ate the apple. Before that, all animals were vegetarians, and the season was always spring. If only Adam had been content with peaches and nectarines, grapes and pears and pineapples, these blessings would still be ours. Self-importance, individual or generic, is the source of most of our religious beliefs. Even sin is a conception derived from self-importance. Burrow relates how he met a Welsh preacher who was always melancholy. By sympathetic questioning, he was brought to confess the source of his sorrow, that at the age of 7, he had committed the sin against the Holy Ghost. "My dear fellow," said Burrow, "don't let that trouble you. I know dozens of people in like case. Do not imagine yourself cut off from the rest of mankind by this occurrence. If you inquire, you will find multitudes who suffer from the same misfortune." From that moment, the man was cured. He had enjoyed feeling singular, but there was no pleasure in being one of a herd of sinners. Most sinners are rather less egotistical, but theologians undoubtedly enjoy the feeling that man is the special object of God's wrath, as well as of his love. After the fall, so Milton assures us, the sun had first his precept so to move, so shine, as might affect the earth with cold and heat, scarce tolerable, and from the north to call decrepit winter, from the south to bring solstitial summer's heat. However disagreeable the results may have been, Adam could hardly help feeling flattered that such vast astronomical phenomena should be brought about to teach him a lesson. The whole of theology, in regard to hell no less than to heaven, takes it for granted that man is what is of most importance in the universe of created beings. Since all theologians are men, this postulate has met with little opposition. Since evolution became fashionable, the glorification of man has taken a new form. We are told that evolution has been guided by one great purpose. Through the millions of years when there were only slime or trilobites, throughout the age of dinosaurs and giant ferns, of bees and wild flowers, God was preparing the great climax. At last, in the fullness of time, he produced man, including such specimens as Nero and Caligula, Hitler and Mussolini, whose transcendent glory justified the long, painful process. For my part, I find even eternal damnation less incredible, and certainly less ridiculous, than this lame and impotent conclusion which we are asked to admire as the supreme effort of omnipotence. And if God is indeed omnipotent, why could he not have produced the glorious result without such a long and tedious prologue?